Welcome to this special audio highlights program of a CME satellite symposium, Real Life Decisions in the Management of Breast Cancer, held during the December San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We work with three oncologists in community-based practice, Drs. Bill Harwin, Paul Fishkin, and Michael Schwartz, to select interesting cases of breast cancer to present to our faculty of Drs. Cliff Huddis, Skip Burris, Mark Pegram, Joe Sperano, and Eric Weiner. I did video interviews of the three treating physicians and asked them to pose questions for the faculty to address about the case, and we also showed photos of the patients to make the discussion more clinically relevant and individualized. To begin, Dr. Schwartz talks about an unusual situation, a 35-year-old woman with a strong family history of breast cancer who initially presented with a node-positive, ERPR-negative, HER2-positive infiltrating ductal cancer who received dose-dense AC paclitaxel trastuzumab and shortly thereafter presented with a supraclavicular lymph node and widespread bone mets. The patient was a known BRCA1 mutation carrier and developed rapid disease progression on lapatinib capecitabine and lapatinib trastuzumab. Dr. Schwartz began by describing the patient's initial clinical presentation with metastatic disease.
It was very difficult. You know, when she walked into the office and you feel the node, you know, you can make excuses at what it might be, but as a doctor, you know this is recurrent disease. I always wondered about her because for BRCA1 to be HER2 new positive isn't that common. But on the supraclavicular mass, we repeated the assay and her copy number, gene copy, was more than 4. So clearly she did overexpress.
So I know she had rapid disease progression through capecitabine lapatinib and then trastuzumab lapatinib. What happened next?
I decided to treat her like she was a BRCA1 triple negative patient and put her on a regimen of carboplatinum, gemcitabine, and bevacizumab, and very rapidly she responded. Her pain went away, and after one or two cycles, her CA15-3, which had been approaching 600 or 700, came down rapidly toward normal, and her imaging studies confirmed what we already knew, that she was having a major response.
Probably the most discussed datasets from the San Antonio meeting were back-to-back presentations of three neoadjuvant trials in patients with HER2-positive tumors that were discussed in the meeting by Dr. Weiner, and we were anxious to see these historic datasets discussed in our meeting. But to begin, Dr. Pegram commented on Dr. Schwartz's case.
At this year's ASCO Breast Cancer Symposium, there was a paper presented by the Mayo Clinic Arizona group looking at patients in their series of over 1,733 patients. They did mutation testing in 132. They found 12 BRCA mutations, of which none had HER2-positive cancers. So the conclusion from this paper is HER2-positive cancer is uncommon, at the very least, in patients with BRCA2 mutation-associated cancers. This is consistent with previous published reports, and I would certainly in this case ask for a second pathology review with FISH testing with a world-class expert in this technology. Obviously, in this case, it's fantastic that she's had such a wonderful response to a carboplatin bevacizumab-based regimen, but looking forward, we're going to have to be concerned about what the next steps might be. And we had a very nice presentation from Alan Ashworth at the AACR Award Lecture yesterday reviewing the activity of the PARP inhibitors in BRCA mutant cases, building on the concept of synthetic lethality that he championed in exploiting vulnerabilities and limited ability for DNA repair activity in BRCA-deficient cases.
So, Cliff, before we start talking about what happened with the neoadjuvant trials, any thoughts about this case?
Well, again, as a general rule, while I suspect that she does not have a HER2-positive cancer, the clinician sitting across the desk from a newly diagnosed patient with uncertainty about the HER2 status on the borderline, I would forgive for erring in the direction of giving a trastuzumab-based regimen. In the end, the greater harm would come from omitting this drug if she's HER2-positive rather than over-treating, as maybe happened here in a HER2-normal situation.
And actually, Joe, we actually had Alan Ashworth here last night for another symposium on triple-negative breast cancer. Any thoughts about what might be the next step with this woman? Are you going to be looking for a PARP trial?
Yeah, I would agree. The next step for her would be a PARP inhibitor, something that included a PARP inhibitor, whether given the fact that she has a BRCA mutation-associated tumor, there's a possibility that, a good possibility that she could respond to it as a single agent, although we don't have much data about combining it with cytotoxic therapy in this situation, and if you've already used two of the cytotoxic partners you would normally use it with. But certainly getting access to a PARP inhibitor would, I think, be an important next step for her, because history teaches us, unfortunately, that the responses in this setting usually would be shorter than an ER-positive disease.
So let's talk about these three neoadjuvant HER2 presentations, Eric. And just briefly, let's get your take on the three papers. Maybe you can comment on what they looked at, what they found.
So in Jepar-Quinto, they looked at 600 patients or thereabouts with HER2-positive breast cancer. The chemotherapy backbone was EC, followed by docetaxel, and it was a straight randomization to trastuzumab or lapatinib. And in this particular study, the in-breast pathologic complete response rate, and actually this is breast and lymph nodes, was superior for the trastuzumab-containing arm versus the lapatinib-containing arm. And the same is true if you just look at in-breast response alone. And, you know, I think that this study says pretty clearly that, at least in terms of in-breast response, that one does better with trastuzumab than with lapatinib.
So, Mark, I was trying to think of another situation where I've seen trastuzumab and lapatinib in a randomized trial. Have we seen that? What do you think is going on here? Was it related to toxicity? Is it a better anti-HER2 therapy? What's going on?
What concerned me about this data set was the dose of lapatinib that was used with the EC docetaxel. Because of the toxicity constraints, the lapatinib dose was only about 1,000. So one could make the argument that that may be reflecting an underdosage of lapatinib rather than superiority of the antibody over the TKI. Perhaps if they would have used a sequence with chemotherapy instead of combination, and if used a full dose of lapatinib, perhaps that would have evened things out. It's just speculation, but I think that this data set was severely limited by the amount of lapatinib they were able to administer. I think something like 30% of the patients dropped out prior to
completion. So actually, in both trials, about 35% of the patients could not receive the lapatinib as planned because of toxicity, but the fact is they actually couldn't give it. So, you know, it is a problem. Perhaps with a different chemotherapy regimen, they might have been able to give a higher planned dose. Although even in the NeoAlto trial, you know, the trend is in the direction of trastuzumab in terms of the straight comparison of trastuzumab versus lapatinib.
The issue here is that this combination was not feasible. That's the point.
Okay. So let's just get all three of them in the order they were presented. It kind of was like a symphony, and this is the way it was played. So, Cliff, what about the NeoSphere study? What did they look at? What did they find?
So it's a pretty complicated design, and I will take some pains to point out it's a randomized phase 2. It's not a phase 3 study, which has to do with size and power. The arms are docetaxel and trastuzumab, the same thing plus pertuzumab, or a non-chemotherapy-containing arm of just trastuzumab and the second antibody, pertuzumab. And then the fourth arm is just the novel antibody, the one you're less used to, which, of course, is the pertuzumab, along, again, with docetaxel. And what jumps out for me at this, in terms of the overall summary, is that the combination of all three drugs really looks better. This is a little different from what we see with some chemotherapy regimens, where there kind of is a plateau in marginal efficacy, if you will. Some kind of chemotherapy seems to be needed. I think the cytotoxic therapy may cause cytologic damage that is not as easily repaired when pathways are inhibited. And I think the combination of trastuzumab and pertuzumab, as shown indirectly in the earlier Basalga phase 2 study, is reconfirmed here as more active. Hitting the extracellular domain of HER2, essentially in two loci, is more active than just one.
Skip, are there any situations, if pertuzumab were available, where you would actually use the two antibodies without chemo, you know, someone who has comorbidities or older? Are there any situations right now where you'd use neoadjuvant trastuzumab without chemo, you know, older patient, comorbidities, et cetera, Skip?
Yeah, it's interesting. I have not done that, but I certainly could envision there would be scenarios. You know, many years ago, we did a pilot trial giving trastuzumab by itself to patients before the addition of chemotherapy was given in the metastatic setting. And certainly those patients did as well overall when the chemotherapy was added on later. You know, the responses were substantial. And so I think in a certain condition with comorbid problems, age or other complicating factors wouldn't be unreasonable at all.
So, Eric, the final study that was presented, NEO-ALTO.
So, NEO-ALTO is a study with three arms, and of course, it is meant to complement the ALTO study, for which we'll have results probably within the next couple of years. And in this study, patients received biologic therapy alone for 6 weeks, and then received either trastuzumab, lapatinib, or the combination of the two anti-HER2 agents, all with weekly paclitaxel.
Maybe comment on the toxicity. This is what Mark was talking about.
Yeah, so once again, the lapatinib could not be given as planned in about a third of the patients, and there were dose reductions, although the starting dose of lapatinib in this trial was a little bit higher. And in terms of the pathologic complete response in the breast, the lapatinib and trastuzumab arms were statistically not different from one another, although, again, a trend in the direction of trastuzumab. But what's remarkable here is that there was a substantial improvement that, of course, was statistically significant with the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab and paclitaxel compared to the other two arms. And this is, you know, quite consistent with both preclinical data as well as the data that came from the O'Shaughnessy-Blackwell trial that was published in the JCO earlier this year that demonstrated that in the refractory setting, the combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib compared to lapatinib resulted in improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. And I think that, you know, this makes us all very interested in seeing the results of ALTO. And, you know, hopefully will correlate with an improved outcome in ALTO for the combination arm.
Skip?
I think it's interesting to go back to the toxicity just for a second. And a few years ago, Suzanne Jones, our PharmD, was the first author, published the data on weekly paclitaxel and Q3-week paclitaxel with lapatinib. And there was a definite drug-drug interaction. There was a 20% up in the area under the curve for both drugs. So going into this, as Mark and Eric both alluded to, the deliverability of the combination, you go into that knowing that you're going to need to hang in there. The concerning part was that 35% of the patients stopped the lapatinib as opposed to managing down the toxicity. So there is going to be some increased toxicity with the taxanes and lapatinib together unless you modify the doses. And I think we need to continue to study that as we move forward.
Mark?
You know, I probably wouldn't consider this a practice-changing experiment just yet until we get the time-to-event data, which is to follow in this trial. And hopefully, I mean, I think what this really positions us for is, will this foreshadow the result of the ALTO study? That will then inform the adjuvant decision that you just asked. But having an increase in path CR does not guarantee that you're going to have improved time to event data with longer follow-up. And so I would probably wait on the sidelines until we saw the progression-free survival data and the overall survival data before I would consider this practice-changing just yet. If you do consider using this combination, be mindful of the fact that when we publish the dose escalation phase 1 study, the dose of lapatinib is 1,000, not higher. So be careful with this combination.
Cliff?
So I agree with Mark, and I would also highlight two other aspects of this. The first is, and it's been said, but let me repeat, we don't know that this improvement in an endpoint translates into anything long-term, and we have seen examples of in-breast PathCR rates doubling without improved long-term outcomes. By the way, many of us now remember that we used to get 50, 60, 70% pathologic complete response rates in systemic metastatic breast cancer with transplant, and it didn't yield anything. So one should be very careful about the surrogacy of in-breast response for the things that we care about ultimately, which is long-term survival. Second thing is there are additional randomized data pending. CLGB has a trial, 40601 with Lisa Carey, that it's asking a very similar question. And it would be quite interesting, and I'm sure sobering, if for argument's sake that came back without showing this differential. This is one study, and so I would agree with the voice of caution. Now, I will say that for the occasional patient who has a locally advanced HER2-positive tumor, where the only thing that matters is the in-breast response,
NSABP.
I have to admit, I would find that to be a tempting situation.
NSABP also has a neoadjuvant
lapatinib
campaign. But I think in the end, Skip may be proven right, that this is a very active combination. I mean, the Blackwell data with a survival benefit in late-stage metastatic disease, all very compelling.
Skip, any patient you might consider this combination in off-study?
A woman that came to mind for me was somebody that would walk in the door with a rapidly growing locally advanced breast cancer where I think I need a response tomorrow and what's my best available data. And I do agree with Mark's comment, very disappointed that the past CRs have not translated yet to better outcomes. And just two quick comments about how fast this is moving. I mean, Cleopatra, which is the trial that looked at docetaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab versus docetaxel, trastuzumab, placebo, has already finished accruing first-line metastatic breast, which is amazing. And then the Marianne trial's already begun, which is the T-DM1 immunoconjugate plus pertuzumab and a variety of randomizations. That's already been initiated. So these are moving very quickly.
So I want to get your take in terms of research also, because we got the Beth trial out there, Eric, looking at bevacizumab with trastuzumab. We got Neoalto. Now we're going to go through this case. We got pertuzumab out on the table. Are we getting into a log jam in terms of doing trials, Eric?
Well, our European colleagues managed to do three trials all at the same time, so I think we're okay. I do want to point out that there was no difference in breast conservation across the three arms in NeoAlto. So just be careful in terms of thinking that this is the regimen for someone where you want to maximize in-breast response, because it didn't translate into something that was meaningfully different for patients.
So, Joe, how would you approach an older woman, let's say 86 years old, with a locally advanced HER2-positive tumor?
If the patient truly did have locally advanced disease that was unresectable and I was forced to give some type of chemotherapy, I might give weekly paclitaxel with trastuzumab.
So, Eric, you all have been looking at paclitaxel, trastuzumab. Would you think about that? 86, 90, 91?
So I actually looked this up last night, the life expectancy for an 86-year-old, which is 5.07 years. So that means half of women like this are not going to be alive for 5 years, and yet you really have to keep that front and center in your mind. Events for patients with HER2-positive breast cancer do tend to occur early on, but I think the challenging choice here is between giving her some kind and gentle trastuzumab-containing regimen now with the hope that you're going to delay or eliminate a problem, or following her and, you know, if and when she develops recurrent disease, and she is quite likely to do so, to then treat her with that same relatively kind and gentle therapy at that point, recognizing that there's some chance she's not going to be alive when that really happens.